So I want to welcome everyone to the third talk in this series of five talks on the liberation from self-belief, which is the third noble truth, liberation from self-belief. And I like everyone to recognize how I'm phrasing liberation or freedom, that stepping out of self-deception is essentially what freedom is. And we can get entangled in a whole variety of different methods and trainings and forget that the central issue in the Buddhist teaching is stepping out of self-deception. That's what it's about. And the trainings can actually increase the sense of self-participation rather than self-understanding, which is where the teaching needs to point. So when we take a method, whatever method we may be undertaking, we want to make sure that it's not strengthening the sense of me, that we're not feeling a new role for ourselves, a new skill, a new involvement, a better sense of self-accomplishment, all of that. That may come, but let's not add to the dimension and the three-dimensional sense of me by affirming that on as an ongoing sense of sophistication in oneself in terms of Dharma experience. Just let it go. Just let the teaching come and let the teaching go. Let the methods come and let the methods go. So tonight's talk is the mind's eye spelled I, not E-Y-E. And again, it's an exploration of this sense of me. And one of the reasons that I mentioned what I did in the beginning was that casual observers, people who participate casually off the streets, this can be a very upsetting and disorienting topic. It can be very confusing to talk about the sense of me being anything but a substantial and permanent. And yet, we have to access this teaching, and to understand where the teaching points, we have to understand this particular dimension of selflessness. And it's often not as easy to get a grasp on this as some of the other pointings of Buddhism. For instance, I remember I was young in the practice and I was listening to my teacher give a talk on the three characteristics of the Dharma, that is selflessness, impermanence, and the suffering nature of grasping. And he was giving it as a public talk, and in attendance were a whole group of Trappist monks who were from Spencer Abbey, which was about 20 miles from the meditation center where I was staying. And then at the end, he met all of us, all the staff, and the teacher met with the gathering of the monks in the basement underneath the meditation the meditation hall. And one of the monks came up to him, the teacher, and I was happened to be in attendance then. And the monk said, you know, I agree with you on the impermanent nature of things. And I can understand that when you grasp, you're going to eventually get hurt through your grasping, desiring needs. But don't tell me there's no soul. Don't tell me that, because I don't believe it. And the teacher that I was with was astute and wise enough not to try to argue that point. And this is not a point of contention. It's not a point of argument. You either see it or you don't. But there's no reason you ever have to argue the Dharma. And especially this, because the statement of the truth of the Dharma, where it points, and arguing about it are in opposition to one another. You argue in order to opinionate, to make your point known, to hold your position, which is the very antithesis of selflessness. So we want to be very careful how we stand up to what we know is true. And so the sense of the assumptions that we have about ourselves versus the direct experience of what the sense of self is, that's where the meditation takes us. We all have a huge assumption about who we are and what we've been, where we've come from, our skills, the image, everything we seem to know. We know our history. And those assumptions have led to a kind of conclusion about the state of our being. And what meditation tries to do is to make inroads into that assumption. It tries to show us through direct experience what the sense of self is, not what we have assumed it to be. Those may be in direct opposition to one another. But unless we begin or have the willingness to see for ourselves, then the assumptions it will remain intact. So you might say that this whole of the Dharma is really to undermine the basic assumptions that the ego has latched itself to, and that it's informing the ego as to the incorrection of those assumptions, so that finally the sense of the egoic sense lets go or releases the need to continually apply the assumptions to all aspects of his or her life. So this sense of me is an interesting thing. You know, it's very interesting. Where do we think we are located? Let's just start like we're just exploring this for the first time. Where do we think we're located? Do we think we're outside of the mind somehow? That we have a mind, but that we're really not the mind itself? Is that what you think? Do we believe that? Like we have a body. Most of us would say we have a body, but that we are not the body. Is that fair to say? In the same track, we could say we have a mind, but we're not really the mind itself. Somehow the mind is happening to me. So where are we? If we're not the body and we're not the mind, where are we? Where are we located? We should be able to find ourselves somewhere, shouldn't we? I mean, if we're outside of it, where are we outside of it? What is outside of it? That, you see, you begin to, even logically, you begin to see the contradictions of our assumptions. And so, okay, so what the meditation begins to suspect is that I might be located within the mind itself. The sense of me, the sense of I, may be something happening within the processing of all the information. Reasonable? Well, let's not assume that. Let's just say, well, that's a possibility. But first we have to do a literature search. Say, okay, I'm not going to buy Buddhist's point of view. Maybe there are other things out there. Let me look. I say, so this is always fun. So we go to Western psychology, which really doesn't say much about the entity at all, except it tries to improve it, tries to get it to be more functional. It makes claim, it assumes that the entity is real, and then tries to improve the reality, the coordination, the assimilation of the reality for that human being so that they live more functionally, more sanely. So the assumption is that the self is real. Then we go to the Hindu tradition. And in the Hindu tradition, they talk about self with a capital S. God knows what that means. But there it is in the literature. And then in Christianity, so in Western psychology, they talk about self with a small s. Hinduism, they talk about self with a capital S. In Christianity, they talk about soul. Buddhism talks about no soul. Some traditions talk about being created by God. Other points of view are that we're not created by God at all, that there is no God. Now, what are we going to make of all that? If you aren't totally confused through literature search, capital S's, small S's, souls, where does it leave us? It throws us completely out of kilter. Or at least it did me. I couldn't figure out what anyone was talking about. But what it often does is that when we only do a literature search, when we only rest upon what is written in the text, we become very opinionated around our belief. And that assures a very dominant and a very antagonistic sense of self, no matter whether you capitalize it or not. The Buddha, when asked about those opinions, from those opinions, asked about capital S, small s, soul, or all the other things, he did perhaps the sanest thing of all. He just was quiet. He wouldn't answer. Because he realized that however he answered would just be another point of view. And however that point of view was confiscated, it would build upon the very sense of self itself. And that there was no sense in it. And so the only thing he could do was to hold the space of quietude, which led to the potentiality of exploration and seeing directly. Whether that in fact ever happened, who knows? But it couldn't have happened with a response. We began to see, just through the mechanics of our life, just through our spiritual inquiry, just through the longing of spiritual fulfillment, we begin to see that what we're really searching for is the end of searching. Are we not? What we are craving for is the end of craving. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed that the wanting doesn't seem to ever end, but the wanting, the craving, what we can only do, the only thing we know to do to end the craving is to obtain the desired goal to which the craving is pointing, ingest it, claim it, own it. And then for a moment we have the craving goes into abeyance. And that's the peace that leads us to feel as if, see, it wasn't the acquisition. It was the absence of the need to have. But the sense of me says, okay, I put an end to that, but then I start feeling the need for more completion outside of me. And the only thing that the sense of me can do when it feels desire is to try to goal-orient and to gain or acquire something in the future that will satisfy this pressing need now. And so from the sense of me, we never put an end to the search. And we never put an end to the craving. Not knowing what the craving is, we continue to crave its end, which just leads to the hell of further desiring and wanting. And so the self is in profound disorientation to life. It feels the problem but has no resolution, no permanent resolution. It doesn't know how to end the problem. And it only knows to use what it has in its reach, its tasks, its intellect, the skills of its own making, to put an end to that which seems to be so annoying, so alluring, so painful. And at some point, the spiritual momentum of using the self to end the self, because there's nothing like the self likes to do but take on more and more difficult tasks, and the extreme, the supreme task, is to get rid of itself. Boy, that's a good one. I'll spend eons doing that one. And so it tries to do everything it can to put an end to something that doesn't even exist. But trying to put an end to something creates the sense that it does exist. And so the more it does to undermine itself, the more it has a sense of place on the earth in which to undermine, if you're following all this. And the self, if it comes to any conclusion on its own, in terms of self-exploration, it's not really to look at itself in experientially to see what it is. It tries to move the boundaries of itself beyond into new journeys, what I call journeys of peril. You know, outward bound, marathon running. To go where no one else has ever gone, faster than, to be in Guinness World Book of Records. Journeys of peril, pushed beyond the limits. See, it's not really interested in knowing itself, it's interested in pushing itself beyond the limits and going into new dimensions, new forms and sense of identification of itself. But the question still persists, no matter how far we push the borders of our lives, of our identity, how far we push them back, what are we? What is this? Well, I mean, if we can just look at our lives, it seems like we've always been around, doesn't it? I mean, it seems to me that since I was born to this age, I've been pretty here. Right? But I can't exactly say I'm fixed. Can you? Can you say that you're fixed and unchanging when you, over the years, you've seen changes, haven't you? So a summation or conclusion about you wouldn't say you're a fixed sense of self, but then you wouldn't really say you were forever changing, because obviously you've been around. It denies the sense of continuity that you've had from the beginning. We're just looking at this thing from innocent eyes, from lay eyes, not meditative eyes. We'll get into the meditative business in a moment. And to say that there's no self, what does that mean? No self. Well, what's this then? What's this thing right here? I feel like I'm around. Basically, from the literature search and from self-examination of my history in a longitudinal sense, I have to come up with I don't know. I don't know. I'm very confused and I don't know. And more than anything, I think the sincere meditator does not want to be fooled. You just don't want to be fooled by this thing. You know, and you don't want an easy answer. You don't want the textbook answer. You don't want to be able to get the exam right. See, no self. you really want to know. You really want to know what there is. And it gives you a kind of an identity crisis. A sense of, well, I mean, what's going on here? In spiritual growth is really a continuous identity crisis. I was reading some time ago about Freud and Jung, who were traveling to Clark College in Worcester to get honorary degrees, and they're on the train together. Two psychoanalysts, and what do psychoanalysts do on their train trip but psychoanalyze each other? So each were taking turns, and this is actually written in Jung's memoirs, so it's a true story. So they're on the train, and Jung starts in on Freud, and I don't know how psychoanalysis works, but at some point Freud was taken to a place where he refused to go. And he yells out. He says, "My authority," he says. In other words, "I'm not going to give up. Where you're going to take me, I'm not going to have the authority that my life depends upon." Now, see, that's a resting place of identity. Now, each of us quite likely have a resting place for our own identity. I'm not belittling Freud for having a resting place. But if we're going to get into this business, we should know where that resting place is and be honest with it, not be fooled into thinking that we can do a lot of work, but we got this resting place that we can always fall back on. To know that place and to see what we're unwilling to give up, which means not to give up. You see, you don't give up anything. All you do is see it. In this business, all we're doing is seeing where we're resting. If Freud were to say, "Oh, God, interesting, I'm resting on my authority." So that's something I would, if I were his teacher, which I say very humbly, I would say, "Just see that, Sig. Just look at it. Don't do anything about it. Just know that place. See where it is that we refuse to move, where it is we refuse to budge. See that. And see why it is, what you're gaining from resting on your authority. What are you getting from that? And what's the limitation?" Well, the limitation was obvious in this display of psychoanalysis. You refuse to move into any further depth of yourself beyond the border of what you know to be true or what you think to be true about yourself. And when you're a spiritual seeker, when you're when you long for the truth, you could only stay so long. Once you see where you're resting, you could only stay so long before you're willing to move on beyond that particular limitation. So the question you see is, am I outside the mind? So we're looking at this question, am I outside the mind? So a good meditator sits down. Now I'm kind of showing you now, what I hope to show you, is how the meditation works towards the understanding of selflessness. Okay? Not that there isn't a self. There is a self. It's just not what we think it is. That's all. To deny that the sense of self exists is wrong. It exists temporarily, circumstantially, conditionally. That's all. So we are really interested in knowing the conditions in which it arises and what it's like when we release the need to foster those conditions. We're not trying to get rid of anything, and we're certainly not trying to undermine it or eliminate it. It has a point and a purpose. You have to know the sense of self has a very definite purpose. You have to know the difference between yourself and that door in order to get through it. So the sense of me has a profound and substantial need in our life. It's an important. But is it a resting place? See, what we're doing is just trying to understand it. So in meditation, we begin to sit down and look and see what this mind is. And we just do that. And we begin to get a sense that the egoic sense of me, I, am a part of this mind, not outside of it. Now, this is very important, you see. If you're outside of it, then you have a problem with your mind as an appendage to you, like you broke your leg, right? You've got to get, you know. But if you're in the mind, that changes the whole nature of what you do when there's a problem. Now that's very important, because what we constantly try to do is to divide the mind, the sense of me, into two. The part that I like, that I claim ownership. The part I don't is the recalcitrant part that I'm going to try to control. And there I'm going to try to... But so from that, the idea of me being outside the mind, looking in, then the tactics of trying to control it or manipulate it or change it or improve it make perfect sense. But if you're inside the mind and you have a problem and you realize that anything you do just creates further disconnection, further division from that problem, then what do? The sense of you, the sense of me, see, in opposition to whatever it is that's going on in the mind, is the mind dividing itself into two. But if the sense of me is in the mind, then what struggling with myself, against myself, makes no sense. None. So what we begin to do in meditation is to get a sense that this me, the egoic me, the story of me, the small me, as some teachers say, is entirely a mental fabrication. Entirely a mental fabrication. Now, how do we come to that point? How do we get the sense of that? Because awareness doesn't see anywhere else it can be. It's either in the body or it's in the mind. I mean, there ain't no other place. There's no other place to reside in. There's no hotel room. There's no, you know, electrodes. It's got to be here. And so when we begin to look inside to see where I've got to be, I have nothing left than to conclude that the sense of me resides in the mind. Therefore, now listen, this is not a big leap. The sense of I, the sense of me, is an experience. It's an experience. Now, we need to know something about an experience. How about this? That all experiences are conditional. They arise dependent upon other conditions. That all experiences are in transition. They don't last. What experience have you ever had that lasts? All experiences. And then what is an experience? It's a sight, sound, smell, taste, or thought. So the sense of I is an experience. It's so interesting that we take it to be more than an experience. How would we even know we were around unless it were an experience? And as we begin to move into the mind and look from quiet attention to all the things that we are experiencing, what do we see? We see the sense doors. And in Buddhism, there are six senses, not five. There are the five basic senses and cognition. That can be experienced. Cognition can be experienced. And when we are quiet in meditation, all six senses are experienced. And lo and behold, we see nothing of any substantial nature to any of that. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we observe everything that's going on in the mind. It's possible to be so quietly aware in oneself that there is nothing that is unconsciously driving the experience at all. Everything is seen as an experience. Now, when everything is seen as an experience, there's nothing left that I could be. There's nothing left. There's no placeholder that the sense of me, is having the experience from. Because when we look at where it's coming from, all we see is more experience, which means we see a thought or a memory or an attitude or some way that we are forming ourselves around a past recollection. And when we're quiet, we can see that. We can actually see that and pierce the belief, the assumption, that there's something else that's more permanent there than just the arising of sight, sound, smells, tastes, and thought. Now that's very confusing. Because who is it that's seeing it? At this point, there is no one seeing. It's just seeing. It's just seeing. It's just awareness. Awareness has no owner. Now we're getting very close now to the possibility of moving beyond the limitation and isolated position that we find ourselves in. That awareness, you see, the Buddha said something, it's very interesting. Somebody came to the Buddha and said, "Sir, what is the locus of all the senses? Smell, taste, touch, what is the locus? Where can they all be seen?" And the Buddha said, "The mind. The locus of all the senses is the mind. When you look at the mind, you see, when you look at it, what it is, it's all the senses coming in." Okay, then the guy says, "Okay, so what's the locus of the mind? What holds the mind?" And the Buddha said, "Awareness. Awareness holds the mind." That is, from awareness, the entire mind can be seen. And then the man presses the point even further and he says, "What's the locus of awareness?" The Buddha said, "Nirvana, freedom, the absolute, God, if you will, capital S self, if you will." So what we're doing is really following that formula. We're following the formula. We're seeing where the senses come in. What's holding the senses but awareness? When awareness sees the entire sense data, the assumption of me is no longer outside of that sense data. It now knows for a fact that it doesn't exist beyond just the sense of experience. It's just a sensory experience of me. And when we know that, there's no doubting. There's no need to read the texts any longer. It's over now. It's over. We still get lost. We still get lost and reactive because we just do. But the game is over. But we have to know how this sense continues to form itself to perceive itself as being a person. And as you begin to look even deeper into the mind, you'll see that when there is a gross experience, there's a gross sense of me. And when there's a very subtle experience, like a quiet mind, the sense of me is very quiet. Gross experience, like a reaction, gross me, anger, righteousness. Subtle experience, like a quiet mind, just resting in a quiet mind, very quiet sense of me. We also see that the sense of I arises with the objects that it sees, because the sense of I isolates and holds and grafts onto those objects. And so the sense of I arises out when I particularize or isolate anything out of the environment at all. We say, there's pain in the knee, it's, oh, my pain. Oh, God, my pain. We have an emotion, oh, my anger. My anger. It latches on, it arises out. As it sees and isolates an experience off from the vastness of all experience, as it isolates one quality of that experience out, anger, then it claims ownership. From that isolation, it claims ownership, my anger. And we see that the subject and object arise together. They have to. They rise like two poles of a tent. And now we're on to this thing. Now we're getting a feeling. But what can I do about it? You see the question? What can I do about it? We can do nothing about it. We pulled the carpet out from under our reactivity to do anything to get over ourselves. Because I'm part of the mind. What am I going to do about the mind when I'm part of the mind? What am I going to do with something I don't like when I'm part of that I don't like? The more I react to what I don't like, the more stronger sense of I as separate from it arises. The more frustrated I get, the more annoyed I get at the experiences of life, the more I rise in opposition to those. So what I can do is to be still. That's what I can do. To be still. Because I see that whenever I arise, the sense of I is an experience. Why struggle with it? If I'm not that, which I have been able to see by the very fact that I can see it, I know that I'm not that. I'm not my thoughts. I'm not my emotions. I'm not my body. I'm not my attitudes or beliefs, because they can be perceived. Once they're perceived, the perceiver, the subjective and objective, cannot arise, cannot be the same thing. To have an object, you have to have a subject. And the subject has to be outside the object in order to see it. So the fact that we're seeing this means that we cannot be it. Okay, so then why struggle with anything? If it's not you, why struggle? Why struggle with your pain? The more you do, the more you will have increased anxiety and fear, differentiation from the pain itself. Because you will rise in direct proportion to your disgruntlement about the pain. When you're angry, if you do anything about the anger, I'm an angry person, now you have a problem. Because you just took the egg, Humpty Dumpty, and broke it in two. And you begin to see that life does not need further division. What it needs is stillness. To be quiet. To release the argument. To release the resistance. Because we see it. All that I can offer the moment is quietude. All that I can offer the sense of me, however it's manifesting, is stillness. And then it's under its own law, rising and passing away, arising and passing away. There's the story of Manjushri, who is a sincere seeker going to the mountaintop to visit a renowned teacher. And he's walking up a very steep mountain path. And he sees this bald-headed man coming down. carrying a sack on his back, like a hobo on a stick. And he, just out of curiosity, says to this man who's coming down the mountain, says, sir, what do you know about this enlightenment thing? And the man, who happens to be the teacher, but Manjushri doesn't know it, takes a sack and releases it, and it falls to the earth. At the moment that the sack touches the earth, it said that Manjushri was enlightened. He understood. And then Manjushri said to the man, now what? And the man picks the sack back up and walks down the mountain. We are here to explore ourselves, to come to the depth and understanding of our inherent empty nature, selflessness. Through all the pomp, the circumstances, all the crying out, all the screeching, all the screaming, all the agonizing, the writhing, all of the drama, all of that is senseless. And we begin to see that. But that's not the end of the story. We then go out into the marketplace and bring forth that empty quality to interface with life itself, from life itself, abiding in life itself, without differentiation. And therefore, every act is an act that binds and heals and doesn't further divide. That's what the meditation, that's where the meditation is pointing. To understand ourselves fully and to be fully engaged through that understanding. This isn't a sideshow. This isn't a freak show where we're learning how to come to some esoteric understanding that will make us more estranged from life, more unique to life, so that people can look and say, look at that man. Look how much he or she has accomplished. But to fit back in, connected, interconnected, complete, and allow that manifestation of completion to be the source for all healing. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? As we sit, what are you doing to yourself? What are you bringing? And who's bringing it? Are you outside the mind? If you're outside the mind, then you do have a problem with your mind that needs fixing, because everyone's does. But if you're inside the mind, as part of the mind, a part of the expression, the experience, mental, then what's one part of the mind going to do to another part? And if you stop doing anything, those two halves may come together in wholeness. Okay, so any questions or comments about anything? I'd be happy to... Yes.
I was approached by a workmate today, this morning, and he said the problem with you Buddhists is you don't protect yourself. He says you're peaceful. He says, how do you protect yourself? And I found answering this question. First of all, I didn't want to answer this question.
So you're throwing it to me. Okay. So the question is, how today at his workplace, somebody came up to him and said, the trouble with you Buddhists is that you don't protect yourself. You don't protect yourself. And there's an interesting story about a Taoist story about a boat that had three or four people on it. And they were all occupied in some way. And suddenly another boat hit their boat. And they turned in fury to yell at the carelessness of the other boat, of the other captain of that boat that ran into them, until they found out that the boat was adrift and had no captain. And therefore they had no one to argue. The point is that protection, if you mean physical protection, that's one thing. But what is it that we're trying to protect or defend? What point of view doesn't have its corollary, have its opposite truth? Any relative point of view is relative from the perspective of the person speaking. When you begin to see that whatever side you're taking is only one of a number of perspectives, it's humbling. And somebody who is willing to listen to another point of view rather than to assert their own is driving an empty boat. When you're accused of something, and the fact that you're not defending yourself, perhaps an explanation is needed, in which, if it is, it will be offered. But if it's not needed, then your own integrity is your greatest, is the place where you reside. Not in the defense or the need to have someone feel that you, whatever you did was excusable. Because if they're of the bent to hold you in disfavor, you'll never be able to convince them of that. It's like, have you ever read Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit? Where the antagonists are in hell and they won't leave each other alone. And the end of the book says, hell is other people. Enfer est les autres. Hell is other people. So just, what are you losing? You see, if you were losing something. Now, physical defense is something else. Somebody comes at you in a physical way, then clarity doesn't lack intelligence. Clarity is intelligence itself, and it will move in accordance. It will leave, flee. My cat does that. A dog comes on a scene, it leaves. It doesn't go through this whole sense of guilt and shame or self-incrimination. It doesn't say, damn, I'm not strong enough yet, I'm going to go work out in the basement. It flees. Seems like it's very sensible. I think that's intelligence working.
I started thinking that I thought of Aikido.
Aikido, uh-huh. Right. Where your the form of what you do is to protect the antagonists as well as to defend yourself. You see? So we always come up with reasons why selflessness won't work and why Buddhism is defenseless and why you're all a bunch of passive, go out and you're just going to be lazy and I'm never going to. And it brings back all the memories of what our parents told us we were. You'd be lazy, you'd be passive, you'd be a no good, Nick. Oh, now she's right. No, she's not right. She's not right. Just relax with it. Relax with it. See for yourself. Just relax with it. Don't anyone that has listened to this talk tonight feel like you're doing anything wrong or you're not doing enough. That's not the point of this talk. And that's why my fear is that if you come to a talk like this too soon, you'll be left discouraged. This is not a discouraging talk. This is within everybody's ability to perceive. Everybody has the ability to perceive everything that I talked about tonight. Because you may be preoccupied with some other details of your life and you're not perceiving doesn't mean you don't have the ability to perceive. The timing isn't right for you. Right? But don't lose heart. Don't get discouraged. This is where it ultimately must rest. And we will all walk this together, regardless of where you consider yourself to be on the path. And most often when I see people, I see them far ahead of where they believe themselves to be when I meet them individually. Yes. The question is about the story I told where the man dropped his sack and then picked it back up again and headed down the mountain. Why would he pick it back up again? Because the heart demands it. You just don't stay. I think for me the metaphor is that you become reclusive. That you never re-engage, that you never hold the challenges of life again, that you find yourself more and more remote, more and more of a hermit, less involved. The heart just won't allow that to happen. It's not a decision. It's just that when you realize the source of pain and you're able to relinquish the need to further divide, the need to feel and to hold that pain individually never returns. But we are all called back into the service of humankind, to the service of life, because that's what being interconnected means. It means we're all connected. And you see that what you might know could be of service for somebody else. And because your heart wants people to be out of their own pain, and it sees that the pain that is being generated is totally self-inflicted, then you want to shout it from the rooftops. Not from an egoic point of view, but say, this is stupid. Why are you doing this to yourself? You don't need to keep poking your eye with your fork. You're supposed to eat with the fork. Okay, so it's just the heart's response. I don't know another way to explain it, except that the heart doesn't. The Buddha is said, when he was enlightened, he said he looked around, he has an eye that could see the intergalactic quality of all the lives and all of that, and he said, "What's the use?" He said, "What's the use?" And he pondered that, so to speak, for 3 days. And then he went out and taught for the next 50 years, 60 years or something. I don't think it was ever in doubt. But it does, when you see it, when you see, you know, when you really see the truth, it's like, what's the use? I mean, it is really, it's like, what's the use? You're doing it to yourself. Just let go. Don't do it to yourself. Don't keep hitting. Don't keep hitting yourself. You know, it's masochism. It's self-induced masochism. Don't do it. Don't raise your fist. And we just don't know how to not. I'm trying not to. But so anyway, I don't know how else to explain that. That's what it feels like. Yes. Right. Yes.
This reminds me of something I read last night. I don't remember the author, I'm paraphrasing, but the day will soon come when more and more of us will not wake up in the morning individually.
The day will soon come when more and more of us will not wake up in the morning individually. I hope so. I look forward to that day. It better come quick. It better come quick. Yes. He's been around a while.
when you raise children,
yes.
You build their self-esteem a lot of what you're trying to do.
Yes.
Build their self-esteem so that they can later give it up.
Yes. Yes.
In a way that makes it seem ephemeral, but yet is effective in allowing them to make decisions that are healthy.
Yes. The question is about raising children so that they have self-esteem and a strong sense of self so that eventually they have the potential to give it up. Without a strong sense of self, you can't give it up because you're driven by your own neurotic pain, which is the sense of self trying to straighten itself out, right? And if anyone who has ever been in mental pain, mental suffering, you realize that it's the worst thing in the world. You can't listen to the outside world. There's nothing else that you can attend to. That it's totally consuming. And when you have something that's in you that feels like a scratch, an itch that can't be scratched, when you have a pain that's in you, that then attending to it, stabilizing, working with it psychologically to get yourself stable is a must for everybody. And so raising kids with a strong sense of self, a strong sense of self-esteem, so that they know who they are and are steady within that knowing who they are and their confidence and all of that, then they have the platform in which they can look out and be interested. Without that stability of self, they have no platform for interest in anything else but in their own pain. And when you're consumed by the pain, there's nothing you want to do except get over your pain, and the only way you know how to do that is not by introspection, but by self-improvement. You see? So that's why this whole meditation business really is on the foundation of self-acceptance. Self-acceptance is an absolute necessity for most of us. Now, do we have to be completely self-accepting before we can look? No. As I mentioned last week, I think, with the analogy of a boat that was leaking, we just want to patch the boat sufficiently so it will rise to the surface, so we can get it afloat. Once it's floating, there are still areas of the hull that continue to leak. That's all right, it's floating now, and we'll still work on those areas to patch them. But it's to get that boat raised from the bottom of the sea up to the sea level so that it can float. And self-acceptance does just that. It raises the thing. It elevates it up to sea level. We all have to be at sea level. Or you're going to use the meditation to circumvent your problem, not to understand your problem, you see? When you circumvent your problem, you really increase the problem. You increase the difficulty. You don't cure anything. The only way to cure the problem, to solve the problem, is through actually understanding what that problem is directly. And you have to do that. You have to be courageous enough to go into the problem rather than to react to the problem, which is what we do when we aren't sufficiently wise enough or stable enough in our self-sanity. It's a very good question. I didn't mind answering it at all. Okay, good. I want to thank you all for your attention.